Let's play some cards.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please.
This is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and professional broadcaster Paul Harris.
You're good, kid. But as long as I'm around, you're second best. You might as well learn to live with it.
You got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them.
Now, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.
Welcome to show number 177. The show in which we almost got to announce that one of the guys hosting this show has a bracelet. Oh, so close.
Well, all the way to the river twice.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Paul Harris. He's Dennis Phillips. He's in Las Vegas. I'm here in St. Louis. And what we're talking about is Dennis's second place finish in the 2012 World Series of Poker Seniors event, the largest one-day starting field ever, 4,128 players. That is almost 400 more than they had in the field last year. And Dennis beat 4,127 of them before getting heads up with Alan Jaffrey Shulman, who is the wife of Barry Shulman and the stepmother of Jeffrey Shulman, the publishers of Card Player magazine. And when it came down to the heads-up battle, even though you had a lead at one point, it just couldn't happen. But second place is, well, you know what? I keep thinking of our friend Joe Seebach, who we had on the show years ago, and he taught us a new phrase, congratulances. Congratulations on second place, but condolences on not winning the bracelet.
Yeah, everybody wants the bracelet. Obviously, that's what we're going for, and it was so close. When it gets down to the river card, and you are the heavy, heavy favorite, and then that magical card shows up there, so you know you're going to keep playing. And it happened a couple of times, but, you know, that's poker. That's part of what happens.
Before we get to the end, let's talk about the tournament itself. 4,128 people. As I mentioned, it's the largest one-day starting field in any tournament in poker history. I think if this thing keeps growing by 300 or 400 people a year, they're not going to be able to do it all in one day. They may have to go to day 1A and 1B of the seniors event. Can you see that happening?
Oh, absolutely. I have no doubt that it will happen, to be honest about that. They were caught a little bit flat-footed, didn't realize it. The first 2 weeks of the World Series out here had actually been down from the previous year. Numbers not quite matching what it was last year. And I think everybody got surprised. They had 480 tables sitting at the Rio. And I was told that that day and Saturday, every single table in the Rio had players at it.
Wow.
Yeah, wow is right. Stuffed to the max is what it was. They were literally scrambling to find dealers. They were calling everybody that they had on the list and telling them, we don't care if you're coming in at 6. You're now coming in now.
Now, talk about the difference between the other huge tournaments, and you've had two incredible deep runs in the main event with a third-place finish and a 45th-place finish. Those both had thousands of people in it. You've played other WSOP events that have had thousands of people in it. What's different about the seniors event, other than the fact that everybody has to be at least 50 years old? What does that do to the tournament dynamic?
Well, it does make a difference. First of all, with the seniors, you only start with 3,000 in chips. And even with our levels and starting at 25-25, it still goes up fairly quickly, and you've got to really protect those chips, and you've got to try to compile them. We lost huge amounts of people on that first day. We played 11 levels and almost made the money. That's how far we went. We lost 88% of the people that first day.
Wow.
There's no way to around it. They're trying to get this done in 3 days. You're starting with 4,000 people. There's going to be an awful lot of people go to the rail. So you have to worry about that. But by the same token, you're trying to get the chips in good. These are grinders there, different from the young guns and everything like that. These people are not going to throw all their chips in on a draw unless they have to and they get short. They're not going to be there, you know, a three-bet bluffing you that often. It's it's a very, very difficult tournament, to be quite honest about it. You know, every now and then somebody will try and make a move. You've got to instantly read these. You have your surprises. I had a couple of different people at my table that did try to get uber aggressive. I had one guy shove all in on the river. I called him with top pair and with a jack and a 10 kicker and, you know, scared to death, to be honest, when I called him. He turned over fourth pair. That's all he had.
Mm.
So, you know, they're definitely capable of making aggressive plays. The gentleman that finished third, which is, he's a hilarious guy. I've got to tell you some stories about him. But Bob Phelps was his name, and he pushed all in when there was like 12 people left, and we're trying to make the final table. Three bet me all in. I mucked, and he turned over a 2-4 offsuit.
Uh-huh.
Looked at me and just grinned. You know, so this is the senior citizen of the final table, the guy that I think he's 78 years old, great guy and everything like that, totally capable of playing all in with any two cards. He did that twice against Hoyt with pure junk, 8-3 one time, I think it was. You know, it's just, it was hard, hard play. And when a guy plays tight and super tight and then puts a move like that, there's no way in the world I'm calling him.
Now, you mentioned that you played 11 levels on day one, and I know on day three you played something like 13 hours before you got down to the final four, and then they put a hard stop on it, and you had to come back yesterday. The final table took 9.5 hours over 2 days. Talk about stamina. I mean, we're not talking about a bunch of 21- and 22-year-old kids here. Everybody here, by definition, had to be over 50 years old. And as you mentioned, there were people in their 60s and 70s and 80s playing in this event. How much does stamina become a factor?
It does. And there were a number of people who were affected by the stamina, and you could tell it, and that were ready to quit when there's still two levels left. You actually could take advantage of people a little bit that way. I'll have to admit that the people who made it to the final table, while they might have been tired, they were the ones that held up the best. They were the ones that were able to endure the 8, 9, 10, 11 hours of continual playing day after day. And they did a great job of it. But you could find some weak people. You could find some people that were slugging coffee down and worried, especially right after dinner. Some of the people made the mistake of going and having a heavy meal and then having to come back and play another 4 hours. And that's, you just can't do that.
Yeah, that's something that you've warned about for people. Well, you gave me that advice because this is going to be my first main event in a couple of weeks. Don't have a big dinner. You talked about that yourself, that you go off, have a sandwich, relax somewhere, calm down, take a break, but don't fill yourself up on so much food that an hour after dinner you're going to want to take a nap.
Yeah, I mean, you have to know your own body, and maybe not everybody's that way. But if I eat a really heavy meal, and I think the average person's the same way, you know, it does tend to make you sleep. You've ground it out. You've been there for hours and hours. You go and have this nice big meal. Then you come back and you got to sit down for another four levels. Wow. Now, that's just wrong for most people. Let's put it that way.
Was one of the other differences in this event that there wasn't all that much Hollywooding going on? People weren't tanking forever, thinking for a long time?
But there was some of that, but it wasn't as much. You know what was pleasant about it? And I super enjoyed this. It was just almost a camaraderie at the table. You didn't hear people getting mad. You didn't hear people throwing junk at each other. You know, there were no penalties, let's put it that way, for the entire series, the entire 4 days. It was just fun. And, you know, somebody would get their aces cracked, and they'd take it like a gentleman, and they, you know, move on. At my table, I saw aces versus aces, and a guy lose to a flush. And that's when we're in the money. And the gentleman that lost there just stood up, laughed about it, and said, there's always next year, went over, shook the hands of the woman that won it, and walked out.
Wow.
It was cool. It really was. My hat's off to him.
All right, now let's go past the first couple of days here and talk about making it to the final table. Ironic that you and the woman you ended up heads up with at the end of this thing, when you got to the final nine, you were the two short stacks, weren't you?
Absolutely were. Mine had bounced around a little bit. Hoyt's had bounced around a little bit. A lot of the other people were fairly steady and building it up. But we were involved in a few more hands than the average person after we got into the money and down to 27 and 18 and such. So I had taken a couple of hits. I doubled a person up when I had ace queen. They ended up having ace king. I lost about $300,000 with pocket queens on a king flop against a very good player. And, you know, so I was down to 500 when I hit the final table and had to be very, very careful.
You mentioned Hoyt.
In ninth place.
You mentioned Hoyt. That's Hoyt Corkins, a guy who's got himself two WSOP bracelets and one WPT title as well. Playing with him at the before we talk about what it's like to play with him, how many other name pros played in this field? I mean, a field of 4,100. It's not all amateurs, right?
Oh, no, no, not at all. And there were a number of them, and several of them, the cat. Cashed on it. Umberto Benes played in it, and he cashed. Marcel Luce played in it, and he made it down to about the final last 40, I think it was. So there were a number of pros that were starting out there. There's quite a few of us guys that are still trying to fight the young guns that are over 50 that are in there. In fact, at my first table, I sat down, and James Woods was there, the actor. Real, real good guy. We had a lot of good discussion. We talked about some of the charities that he works with Wounded, like Wounded Warrior, and that I try and help with. And we've both been out to Walter Reed, and just a real class act. Really, really nice guy who got totally sucked out on, by the way.
So now, with Hoyt Corkins at the final table with you, it's essentially you two are the poker professionals, and there are some others there who may have played a lot of poker in their lives but aren't doing it for a living now, as the two of you are. Did you specifically say to yourself, okay, well, I don't have to play a lot of big pots against Hoyt. I can stay away from him and hope that he stays away from me?
That frankly, that's exactly what I did. We played at the same table back when there was about 50 people left. Then we got together at the same table there at the final table. And I only, until we got down to about six people, I only played a couple of hands against Hoyt. He's a very good player, very capable of pushing, and he's known for his all-in move. He loves to shove all in and put you to the test. So you've got to be extremely careful with him. I had one hand where I'm still, to my dying day, I'll think I had the best hand, but I didn't want to be in a big pot with him, and so I mucked my cards. He had raised. I had an ace-nine suited. Flop came out with a king-nine-five, I think it was. I went ahead and made a bet out there with middle pair and an ace-kicker, and he came over the top big. And there were two spades there. He might have had a flush draw. He could have had a lot of different things. I didn't want to get involved in a big hand. Why would I want to against what I considered the best player at the table?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I just mucked it. I didn't have that much invested. I figured I could pick a better hand.
And that's an important lesson that a lot of people need to learn, particularly about tournament play, where every chip is important and you're going to need to collect all of them at the end of the tournament. In a cash game, you might well have played that hand very differently, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But in this particular instance, you know, why do I want to get involved in a big hand with what I think is my toughest competition and with a guy that's known to be aggressive and to shove the chips out there? No. Even if he's on a spade draw, no. Why should I want to? Let's go ahead and play. I can pick a much better hand.
We got a lot of tweets yesterday directed to you, which, of course, you couldn't answer because you were too busy playing this thing. But Jennifer Lappin tweeted to want to know, were you able to get good reads on the players, particularly at the final table? How much was looking for tells a part of your game?
It actually wasn't as much of a part of my game when I made the final table as was earlier, because there were several people at the final table whose only move was all in.
Yeah.
So the reading is, you know, irrelevant there, to be quite honest about it. If all they're going to do is either fold or shove, you know, you just have to try to figure out what their range of hands to shove with is. And I think I was able to do that. So the reading is irrelevant there when you get to that particular one. Some of the other ones, especially earlier on, oh, yeah. I've got hands I could tell you about. I got 30 hands I could tell you about. You want me to talk about a couple of them where the read was so important?
Absolutely.
We went into day three with 33 players. Gentleman had doubled up on the last hand of day two to over 1.3 million. He was by far the chip leader. Second place had under 700,000. When we played down to 27 and redrew on seats, he ended up moving to my table, and at that time he was up to 2.5 million. He'd already caught quads. He'd already caught a nut flush. He'd taken two people out. He was like a steamroller going on. So he had 2.5 million a gentleman at my table was second in chips. He had chipped up to about a million. I had chipped up to about 750,000. So first, second in the entire tournament were at my table. I was in fourth place at the time, but with both of the chip leaders at my table, including the one guy that was just rolling over everybody. Well, he immediately tried to establish his dominance. First hand he played, blind for 8 and 16. He puts up 60,000 pre-flop. Everybody folds to him. A couple of hands later, I was in the big blind. The gentleman under the gun, who had the other million, raised pre-flop to the sum that we'd been doing, about 35,000. This guy came over the top and made it 80. Everybody folded around to him, including me. The guy that with the million starting chips made the call. Flop came out there, an 8-high flop. He looked at that, and he put out another 80,000. The guy made it 200,000. The guy that was under the gun, that did the original raise, hanged for a while, called him. Came another small card on the turn. The guy checked that was under the gun. The other guy shoved. 2 million into the pot right there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're second in chips. You've got a quarter of your chips sitting out there already. And you think you have the best hand. Talk about putting somebody to the test.
Yep.
He took about 5 minutes, called it, turned over pocket nines. So he had an overpair, but barely. The other guy had an ace, seven of spades. He had a flush draw because there were two spades out there. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
And it blanked on the end. Now then we have a new chip leader. The guy goes up to 2 million. The guy who had been rolling over everybody drops to 1.5 million. And he's steaming over there. You know, he's red in the face, the whole bit like that.
Yeah.
Next hand, I'm the small blind. First, one, two, right in middle position is the guy that's still with 1.5 million. He makes it 60,000 again.
This is the guy who's steaming.
The guy who's steaming. Folds around to me. I look at my two cards, and I just smooth call the 60,000. Everybody else is folded, including the guy with the 2 million now in the big blind. Flop comes queen 10-5 out there with two hearts. I check. The guy makes it another 80,000 out there. I think for a minute, call the 80,000. Turn card is another 10. So it's queen, 10, 10, 5 with two diamonds out there. I check again. The guy rolls his head up and his eyes around, thinks for a minute, and announces to the table 160,000, takes it and splashes it into the pot.
Mm-hmm.
I take a full 5 minutes. I'm not kidding. 5 minutes, and I count out the 160, and I count everything that I have left, and I think about it for a minute, and I look at my cards about four different times, and I keep watching this guy, and his face is getting redder and redder and redder all the time, and I announce all in. And this guy's breath just falls out of him. And he sits over there, and he thinks, and he looks at it. Now, he came to the table with 2.5 million. He's down to 1.5 million. The next hand after he just lost 40% of his chips, I'm going to cost him another 50% of his chips of what he has left.
Yep.
He'll be down to about 700,000 if he makes the call and loses, and he will be just one of the average Joes then. He tanks and throws it in.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't resist it. I turned my cards face up and threw them on the table.
I know you didn't have a 10, and I know you didn't have a queen.
Oh, gosh, no, not at all. I was actually better than you know, I would have had to have been, because I was going all in. I was pretty sure, you know, pre-flop on that. I had an ace-5. Needless to say, the guy went on instant tank. Tilt, sorry.
Yeah.
Instant tilt. He was just fuming. He got up, went to the rail, talked to a couple of his friends, came back, you know. It was fun.
But you were able to do that because you had seen what had happened and how he had played the previous
Correct.
Hand, and because he was giving off all of these obvious weakness tells in this hand, allowing you to make a move with essentially any two cards. I mean, you got nothing there. You don't even have a bluff catcher there. You're on 100% air, but you're playing it because of the way he has been acting and looking and the way he splashed the chips and everything, right?
Absolutely. I mean, he had so many tells there after that because he was on a little bit of a tilt. And obviously, anytime a guy gets a little upset, loses their composure a little bit, their tails come forward in bright red colors. And his was there in flaming neon.
Beautiful.
So, yeah, it was a pretty easy. I mean, had he called, I'd have been so shocked. I mean, I'd have fallen off of my chair.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Paul Harris here in St. Louis. Dennis Phillips is in Las Vegas, where yesterday he finished second out of a massive field of 4,128 people in the World Series of Poker Seniors event. Took down second place for $372K, wasn't able to take down the bracelet, which was won by Alan Jaffrey Shulman. Let's talk about this woman for just a second. I want to get into final table play, but let's congratulate the woman who won this, who is the third member of her family to make a final table, not just in a lifetime, not just in a career, not just in a year, but in the same week. I mentioned her husband, Barry Shulman, is the publisher of Card Player magazine, and he won the WSOP Europe a couple of years ago. He finished earlier this week, late last week, in eighth place in the $1,500 no limit event. And her stepson, Jeff Shulman, also one of the publishers of Card Player, who made the final table of the main event with the Grinder a couple of years ago. Jeff finished third in the $5,000 buy-in limit hold'em event. So that's three members of the Shulman family making the final table in 1 week. And she did the best of all of them, taking this down. That makes her the first woman to win a bracelet in a non-ladies event at the WSOP since Vanessa Selbst won hers in 2008. Allen is also the second woman to win this seniors event. Claire Miller won it 6 years ago. Allen also scored the biggest payday for a woman at the WSOP Vegas with the $603,000 first prize. That beats Maria Ho last year, who took down over a half a million for her 5K runner-up finish. And, of course, Annette Oberstadt did have a $2 million payday at the WSOP Europe in 07, but this is the biggest payday for a woman at the Vegas World Series of Poker. She's also the third woman to earn a six-figure score this summer, along with Vanessa Selbst and Amanda Musumeci. She's also the third woman this year to get down to at least heads up, which both Amanda did and Patricia Baker did. All of those are amazing accomplishments. But I got to quote a listener of ours who tweeted to Dennis, "I know you wanted more women to win bracelets, but you've gone too far this time." Talk a little bit about playing the heads-up portion of this against Alan, who up until that point had really just been a fold or all-in machine. Ironically, her first name is spelled A-L-L-Y-N. All-in is in her name, and that was essentially her one move.
Yeah, she had decided that was going to be her strategy, that post-flop she couldn't play with a lot of other people. She didn't have the experience for it. I think Barry had talked to her. And what she did is she just had a range, and she would look at her two cards, and that would make her decision. It basically took all of the other decisions out. I believe when she made the final table down there, her range was quite simple. Any pair, I shove. Any ace, I shove. Any two Broadway cards, I shove. When I got down to about six-headed, it was any king, I shove. Other than that, I fold. Just that simple. She got it all in with pocket deuces against Hoyt's queen nine, and it held up. She got it in with a king 10 against my ace 8. I called her with an ace 8 and had her all the way to the river. She caught a flush on the river. I can tell you hand after hand where she, most of the time you fold to her. When she shows all in, you fold. But the few times it was shown, those are exactly the hand she had, and that was the way she's playing. And to give her credit, that puts a tremendous amount of player on the other people. You can't play her post-flop. You can't make any moves. You can't do anything continuation plays. It is nothing but, do I want to roll the dice on this one and hope she doesn't have an ace, but she's got the two Broadway cards or a small pair? Or, you know, how do you want to play it? What you want is to catch the monster, you know, when she does that. And, well, I did once. She rolled over a king four against my queens.
Actually, she had king six on that hand.
King six, I'm sorry.
And we'll talk about that hand in just a second. But let's talk more about this specific strategy. When you have somebody at the table who essentially is to your left, she was a couple of seats to your left, and then, you know, when other people got eliminated, she was the one player on your left. And when you were in the final three, Bob was on your right. You were in the middle. She was on your left. And so when you have that situation, there were times I remember when Bob would be the button and he would make whatever his raise was, and you would look like you were thinking to yourself, well, I want to call this guy. I have a calling hand here, but I know that she has only that one move, and it's entirely possible that I'm going to be essentially having to call Bob and then fold to her shove. So how many times was this coming into your strategic decision-making at that final table?
Oh, absolutely. Every time you had to look at it. If Bob was folding, I was raising 80% of my small blinds, at least. There were a few times I actually, later on, I tried a little different strategy. I tried limping a few times and seeing it, because I figured if she missed, didn't have anything, if she had it, she was going to shove anyhow, even if I limped. And if she didn't have it and the flop was mine or whatever, I could still take the pot most of the time. So I did that a few times, too. I played it several different ways. But if Bob raised, I needed a decent hand, because you're absolutely right. If she looked at her cards and all her chips were going in, I didn't want to have to fold. I didn't want to lose $400,000 or $500,000 right there. So, yeah, I folded a couple of hands that I would have normally raised with there. I folded a few hands that I still wonder now whether I shouldn't have called her all in. I had a 9-10 of clubs one time, and I laid it down. I had an ace-9 another time that I laid down. I had an ace-7 another time that I laid down. They were just so close, and I could have been so easily dominated. So it was tough. It made it very, very tough.
Let's talk about a couple of hands. One, when Bob was still in there, I think Bob had raised and you had called, and the flop came out 10-10-4 with two hearts. And he didn't have a lot of chips at this point, and I think you were pretty decent stack. On that flop with 10-10-4 and two hearts, he shoves. And you tanked for a long time, and then I was watching this on the live stream, and by the way, congratulations to David Tuckman and his producers, Jess Wellman and Jay Noonan, who were getting guests in there with him as he was doing the commentary for the live stream, because I thought he was doing an absolutely phenomenal job, not just with yours, but then later on going and doing the 10K horse event. And he's been doing these final tables almost every day during the WSOP 12-hour days and is doing a great job. But anyway, I'm watching the live stream, and you actually flashed a face card. I couldn't see what the face card was, but you then folded. Now, again, we're talking about a 10-10-4 two-heart board, and he has shoved all in. You said that you had a pair there, but I can't believe that you would fold jacks or queens there. I know you didn't have kings because you would have put a lot more money in the pot pre-flop. Did you have a pair there? What did you have? What was your process again, thinking it through there at that point?
Yeah, I did. I had a four.
You had a four? That's what your pair was on a 10-10-4 board. You had, like, what, jack four or queen four or something like that?
Yeah, I can't remember what it was. I think it was queen four.
So were you thinking about actually making that call there?
Oh, heck yeah. Absolutely. Bob was quite capable of doing that with nothing but air. I actually thought he probably had the two hearts. He liked flush draws. He'd thrown in all his chips several different times when he had the flush draw. And I got to thinking about it. If he has two over cards and a flush draw, I'm probably behind anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
So forget it. I don't need to risk my chips at this time. And it was a fairly easy fold, actually, but I just had to think through it.
Well, eventually, Alan took out Bob, and you got to heads up with her. And at that point, she had, I think, more than a 3-1, maybe even more than a 4-1 chip lead, right?
At one time, she was about 4-1, correct. And I will say then she tried to play different, tried to play some post-flop plays. I chipped up a couple of million, and then we got it in on essentially a race.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about a couple of the hands that you played against her.
Okay.
One where you were, I can't remember who was the button here, but it was the hand where you had the nines and she had the mm-hmm. jack 10, and somehow all the chips got in pre-flop. I was shocked after having watched her play for so many hours and knowing that her range was fairly thin that she would get it all in with jack 10 offsuit against you.
Well, not only that, but again, it's the way I described it. I think that was Barry's instruction. She had two Broadway cards, therefore you shove. I actually shoved first with the nines. She called me with a Jack 10.
Yeah.
And insta-called. Looked out two cards and insta-called, which, you know, normally I would have loved that it happened to turn out to be a race, which was fine. I ended up winning that race, but that's what I'm saying. Her range was simple, especially when we go down to four-handed. Any ace, any king, any two Broadway cards, any pair, my chips are in.
Yep.
That's it. You know, really, really simple. Boom. And, you know, that was very close to what I might be off just a hair, but I'm telling you, that was very, very close to what she was doing.
So when you shove with a pair of nines and she insta-calls, you got to be thinking to yourself, whoops.
Well, I'm hoping for ace king there, basically.
Right.
She turned over Jack 10, and I kind of went, well, it's the same thing, but that wasn't what I was expecting.
So that doubled you up, and that really got you back in the game, and then you were the chip leader, and then there was the hand with you having a pair of queens, and she has king six. I think you raised, and she shoved with king six, which would go with your strategy of get it in with any king at that point, if that's what her instructions had been. You happily called with your pair of queens. The flop came out 9-8-4. Dave Tuckman on the stream said, let's have a 7 for a sweat. Instead, we got a 5 for a sweat, and then the 7 came, giving her the 9 high straight. At that point, I'm at home, and I'm actually standing up at my computer watching this, because here's my friend Dennis Phillips. He's one card away from winning his first bracelet. So I know what was going through my mind and everybody else who was watching the live stream. What's going through your mind at that point?
Well, I'm just trying to think if I could send a death threat to the dealer or something, but, you know, no.
I mean, before the 7 comes out, are you thinking to yourself, here it comes? Or are you thinking...
Yeah, I'm almost celebrating already. It's that close. You know you're a 90% favorite. You know all you got to do is avoid that river card, and it's such a limited number. She could have got a king or a 7. Those were the two cards. That was it. Anything, any of the other 11 cards, and I'm home free. Didn't happen. So.
Now, after that, it seemed to me like you kind of sunk back a little bit because you'd been right there on the precipice. You'd had that incredible high of being nearly a bracelet winner. And it seemed, because I've known you for so long, like you sunk back. And you knew you had to still play hard, but it really like was a shot to the gut.
It was a little bit, and I had to regroup. I actually, in hindsight, probably should have asked for like a 5-minute break just to walk around or something like that. Probably would have been a wise idea to do. I didn't do that. But then, to kind of back up a second, when I won the nines versus the Jack 10, that gave me, you know, almost a 5-to-1 lead, a 4-to-1 lead is what it was. And she went back to stop trying to play anything post flop. It was a shove or fold, shove or fold. Even then, after she doubled up there, where I have 7 million, she has 5 million. It's the very same thing, shove, fold, that type of deal. And that's where I started getting these mediocre hands. I laid down a 10-9 of clubs. I laid down an ace-9, both of which, well, one of which, actually, when she took them and throwing the cards away, when I had the ace-9, I saw a king there. And I'm going, no, why didn't I call this time? Why didn't I do it? Mm. You know, I just couldn't pull the plug to do it.
Yeah.
So then when she shoved another time, when I had the ace, I just... That's it. I'm in. Let's see what happens. Turns out she had an ace with a bigger kicker.
Right. This was the last hand. She limped the button. You raised ace six. She insta-shoved ace 10, and you insta-called, figuring, well, you know what? At least I'm going to have a 30% chance here, right?
That's the minimum on it. And I was hoping she had another king or a jack 10 or pocket deuces or so many of the other hands that she shoved with.
Unfortunately, so. the board blanked off, and... That was the end of the tournament. You took down second place, as I said, $372K. Not bad for a $1K investment.
Yeah, not just 372 times your money. Not bad.
But a listener named Jerry tweeted this question for you. When you got down to 3 left, were you thinking about what's the pay jump to second place, or are you only thinking about the bracelet?
No, at that time, I'm only thinking about the bracelet. I guarantee it. You've already got a great run. You've already done well. You've got a solid cash. I'm only thinking the bracelet. I will admit, when we got down to the final 9 and on the short stack, I was just looking to see, make sure I can get at least in 7th, 6th, 5th place, something like that.
Yep.
But when you get down to 3 or 4 people, oh, no, it's bracelet time.
A couple of other questions let's get to from listeners here via Twitter. Mike says, Dennis, I noticed you showed aces a couple of times and other times other cards. Were you doing that to try to get the other players to show you their cards?
That was part of it, yes. I was trying to do it. Bob a couple of times didn't show me his cards. It helped out a little bit. I also, because I was raising so often, you know, every small blind basically against her I was raising, I wanted her to, whenever I did have something, you know, well, hey, you know, it's not all there. I do actually have hands here, that type of stuff, too.
Okay.
And I think that sunk in a little bit. But the problem was she had a strict regimen. It didn't make any difference what anybody else did. Her play was predicated totally upon what two cards she had.
Andy says, I was watching the entire final table. I saw you really turn up the pressure with six left, and then when it came down to the final four yesterday, it seemed from the start that your plan was just to put pressure on because you were the chip leader. Was that your strategy?
Well, that was part of it, absolutely. I was a little worried about Hoyt. If you'll notice, a lot of times when he was the big blind, I wasn't putting quite as much pressure on it, but because he's so capable of the shoving. But other than that, yeah, I wanted to put pressure on. I wanted to make them think. I wanted to try to pick up the blinds and the andes. Do you realize how huge those blinds and andes were at that time? You know, just picking them up is a great hand almost.
Yep. Another Andy writes, tell us about the crowd in the arena. It sounded really loud. Was it full in there? The arena is where all the final tables, well, not all the final tables, most of the final tables get played out. And it did sound on the live stream like there were a lot of Dennis Phillips supporters and others in there yesterday.
Oh, there absolutely was. On day three, when it finished up, they were crowded around there. They were several deep on the sidelines, a whole bit like that. Everybody was watching what was going on. It was really good. When day four started, we were not able to get in there until literally 5 minutes till we started. So we were the first people allowed in. We walk in there, open up our bags, and start playing. And then everybody else started filtering in. So there wasn't another table in the entire room that had any players at it. So when we first started the first hour or so, day four, there weren't a lot of people there, but it rapidly filled up.
All right, Jared wants to know about the no verbalizing rule. We had talked about this a couple of weeks ago on the show about how initially they had set up a rule that said when you get to a final table, you have to verbalize it. Then about five tournaments in with the complaints from the players, they decided not to have that rule in effect, but they would encourage players. Did they tell you and the other players anything when you got to the final table? And would you have preferred, considering it was mostly amateurs, for everyone to have been forced to verbalize?
Well, I hadn't really thought about that. It didn't give us any instructions. They didn't mention it at all. A couple of times I asked Robbie, the guy, the announcer there, you know, well, now I can talk okay here and all this other stuff just to make sure because I wanted to make sure I didn't do anything improper. I guess I probably would have encouraged them having everybody vocalize it because a couple of people were really nervous, were really sitting there tight, and were trying not to say a word. Now, Bob was the exact opposite. God, he was a hoot. There was one time he shoved in against Bill, the gentleman who was in the 9 seat. And Bill went into the tank. And Bob was standing up and everything like that. And he actually reached over the table and picked up the trail mix and offered him some to the guy while he's trying to decide.
He was a character, wasn't he?
He was a character. He's a great, great guy. I mean, he's retired now, and he does a lot of hunting and fishing. And I just bet you I could sit in the duck blind with him for hours and have fun. You're a great guy.
All right, another question from a listener named Gary who says, I've heard you guys talking about the delayed live feeds and information getting back to the players. Was anybody telling you what Dave Tuckman and his analysts were saying? Which I guess is a kind of a moot point because there were no hole cards on the live stream, so it was all about speculation and strategy by Dave and whoever he had in the booth with him. Was anybody giving you information about what was going on there, Dennis?
No, didn't get anything that way, and I don't think I wanted it since the hole cards weren't shown. You're right; it's just pure speculation. Tuckman was not at the table; didn't see the way the play was going there when you're down there facing it face to face. I respect his analysis a lot, believe me, but no, I wouldn't have wanted it, to be honest.
when everything was over, before they handed the bracelet to Alan Jaffrey Shulman, Ty Stewart, who is the executive director of the World Series of Poker, got up there and said some very nice things about you, about how you were kind of the godfather of the November 9, about how all of your fans showing up back in 2008 to be there in the Penn & Teller Theater at the Rio had really made that event and set the standard for what it was. Even though at that point your heart is a little bit broken by not winning the bracelet, that must have felt good.
Oh, it did. Ty's a really good guy. We've become friends. I hung around with him a little bit over in Europe, the WSOPE. I've got a relationship with him now because of the photography business that's out there. So we've become friends, and, it was just nice compliments. I wrote it the night before, so, no big deal.
And one more Twitter question. Michelle says, I heard your show with Mike Sexton when he talked about his bet with Brian Hastings that a player over 40 will win the main event this year, and that Barry Greenstein has bought part of the bet. What do you think of that bet now that you've played in this massive field of seniors?
Well, I'm over 40, so anyhow. No, I'm telling you what, that was a tough competition. There's a tremendous number of players out there that are quite capable of winning that main event, and they're probably going to make some deep runs. And there were 4,128 of them that were out there that were trying to do it and got good experience. The guys that made it to day three, that's a lot of very, very valuable experience that they gained, because it's the main event's going to be somewhat similar. It's going to be a different type of a table and everything, but, good experience going 2 and 3 and 4 days deep on a tournament.
Yep.
So, it's not bad.
Stamina will come into play, of course.
Oh, it absolutely will.
But, with the I would say the main event certainly has a smaller number of people in their 60s and 70s than this event will, and probably a higher number of people in their 40s. So they might give it a shot, and Dennis and I, both being in our 50s, would like to think that we might have, well, I have no shot. Who am I kidding?
Yes, you do.
I've told my friends that I'm setting the bar as low as possible. I want to make the first dinner break. For my first year, I'll be happy with that. But listen, we did a special show here today where we talked mostly about this, and I really, as a your radio partner and as a friend, I really want to congratulate you. I mentioned at the beginning how heartbreaking it was to not see you win that gold bracelet, and I know you must have felt that way as you were driving home from the Rio yesterday, but still a big return and a big finish. And last time you got to heads up in a major event, your appendix burst on you, and yet you had to fight through that to win the ring on the WSOP circuit. At least you didn't have that this time.
I don't have any more spare body parts, I'm afraid. That was my limit. So, yeah, that was good that I didn't have to fight through that.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, no problem. Do we have a couple of minutes left? There was one thing I wanted to kind of a nice story there at the final table.
Absolutely.
That happened.
We got plenty of time.
One of the guys there, a guy by the name of Lance, was following his buddy who made the final table, and it's going on, and his flight is going to be leaving here at about 6 o'clock on Sunday night, and he really can't afford to change his flight, and he has to work on Monday, so he begrudgingly says goodbye to everybody, real nice guy, and goes to the airport. He's standing in line, and the counter person says, "We're overbooked. Anybody want to take a later flight?" He says he literally started jumping up and going, "Pick me, pick me, pick me." And it worked out so perfect. They put him on a midnight flight, didn't charge him an extra dime at all. He was still going to make it home in time to go to work. He could come back to the Rio and cheer his friend on, and they gave him a voucher for $600.
Wow. How did his friend do?
His friend made the final table, finished very well. So, yeah, everything went well. He was actually still there when his friend busted out. But really nice guy. I'm telling you, I made some new friends at that table, some really good people. I'll carry some memories of Bob for a long time. And it was just looking back at it, it was just a huge win-win situation.
Oh, I know one other thing I wanted to ask you about, which I noticed on the live stream, and that's that you were wearing a button that said chip in. I think it said chip in for one drop. It was hard to see on my computer screen what that was. Tell our audience about that.
Yeah, thank you for reminding me of that. 1N is now the official charity of the WSOP. Guy Liberté, the gentleman who owns the Cirque du Soleil, is kind of the founder and driving force behind this. It's Canadian-based charity that's now expanded worldwide, and it's for providing good drinking water for all people everywhere. They've got a number of projects going all around the world trying to provide clean drinking water for people, which is so vital. And he sponsored the $1 million buy-in where 10% of your entry is going to go to One Drop. At the photography booth, we're trying to set up something there so that we can give a little bit of a kickback. We think we're going to have some of the players autograph some photos and sell it, and then the proceeds go to One Drop. And I was more than happy to wear the button. I'm more than happy to make a donation to that cause. Very worthy cause, very good guy pushing it forward, and, you know, another charity that needs support.
Is this kind of like Phil Gordon's bad beat on cancer a couple of years ago at the WSOP, where the WSOP itself is embracing this as a charity and encouraging players to not just be aware of it, but to wear the button and donate maybe 1% of their earnings to the charity?
Correct. That is it exactly. And like I said, it's a worthwhile cause, very well supported by a number of other poker players. And I was happy. I was asked to wear the button. I was happy to do it.
Are people who contribute to this only and wearing the button only in the bracelet events, or could somebody like in a deep stack event say, you know what, if I do well in this, I'll give 1% to the charity?
Oh, absolutely. And those deep stacks are going so ridiculously big now. I mean, 1,200 and 1,300 for some of these deep stacks. First place, 40,000 or 50,000. So absolutely, any and all donations for that, it's a worthy cause. Whether you win or not, if you can help out the cause, I encourage you to do it.
Yeah, I noticed, by the way, on those deep stacks, you know, $235 buy-in, and you end up for $40,000 or $50,000 for first place. And then there are the deep stacks that start at six. That's the 2 o'clock. There's a 6 o'clock deep stack, which I think is under $200 buy-in, and another one at 10 o'clock. And in those, you're literally playing until after the sun comes up in Las Vegas if you make it to the final table. So you're a winner and you're walking out into the sunshine of Las Vegas with a pretty big check in your pocket. That's another one of the things that people may not realize who've never been out there. You know, we talk so much about the bracelet events and the winners and, you know, Dennis in the seniors event and the huge field that they have there, and people like Phil Ivey and Phil Hellmuth, who each have had multiple caches already, and some of the young players who won their first bracelets. That's not the only story that's going on inside that building, right?
Correct. And don't forget the sit-and-goes that you were doing so well with. I played a handful of those, and I'm cashing or chopping 80% of them so far.
Yeah.
So those are pretty nice, too. But 480 tables, and they filled every single table Friday and Saturday and I think Sunday. Wow.
That's phenomenal. So today, obviously, is a day off for you after four tough days in the senior event. You know, there are a lot of people there who are grinding each and every day. I actually think you're smart to take a day off. But then what's your schedule for the rest of this week and the next couple of weeks coming up before the main?
Well, the next couple of weeks have quite a few no-limit tournaments down there. I'm going to be playing a number of them, trying to keep sharp, trying to get ready. Whatever I can do to improve my game and to be ready for the main event, that's my focus right now. So any kind of sharpening of, if I think I need to play a couple of sit-and-goes, I will. If I think I need to play a couple of the bracelet ones, I will. If I need to take a break and do something different to clear my mind, I'll do that. If I need to go play a Raz game just for something different for entertainment, I will. But whatever, my ultimate goal will be to ready as I possibly can for that main event.
Got a change in predictions on how many people you think will be there? I know I was overly optimistic before the whole thing started, thinking they'd have a huge turnout this year. We might get close to 8,000. We have to revise that number down. I can't remember what the official over-under was, or not official, but when we looked on the Bovada website before the series, what did they say, something like 6,350 or something like that?
No, 6,850.
6,850. What do you think now?
I still think, especially after this last weekend, it's kind of been building up. The first 2 weeks were a little smaller, but it's building up now. I think they'll surpass that. I think they'll be over 7,000 again.
Wow.
Yep.
I got to beat 7,000 people.
You only got to beat them one at a time, one table at a time.
Well, you just did it in a field of 4,128. You came in second, and that's a huge deal. And congratulations to you again on that. And next week we'll regroup for another show. We'll have more of the guests that we have recorded here. We've got people like Maria Ho and Corey Zeidman and Matt Glantz and some of the younger bracelet winners this year, like Nick Jivkov. We've recorded interviews with all of them, and we'll have them on future shows. But we wanted to give you one show today dedicated to Dennis's biggest score of the year. Is this your biggest score since the main event of 2008?
Yeah. I've had about 4 six-figure caches, but this is the biggest. So that's cool.
Yeah, that is very cool. Congratulations on that. Thanks to our listeners for joining us here Tuesday afternoons at 3 on 590 The Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com. And a reminder that our podcasts are available. And by the way, Dennis, I didn't tell you this before the show. I checked our stats. The month of June 2012, our biggest month ever in terms of downloads of the podcast. More people have visited finaltableshow.com and listened to the show with the streaming audio there, or via iTunes or Stitcher Radio, or our replays on Wednesday nights on Hold'em Radio. With all the different platforms we're on, this is our biggest month ever, and we really, really, really appreciate that support. So check us out any of those ways and join us again next week for another Final Table Show with Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris. Thanks for listening.